So what we've got next for you is the final talk, and that's by Venerable Changzi, which is also our teacher. So in the Chinese tradition, we must stand when our teacher's going. But what I'd like to give a little intro with is, unlock here. His talk will be on some important points about meditation. So remember, when you practice meditation, there are many aspects that you need to bear in mind. And so given the quick 30-odd minutes that we've got for each talk tonight, he's selected some key aspects that hopefully will also help you in your practice and your learning of how to meditate.
Okay, thank you very much, Venerable Yan Rong, for the introduction. I'm a bit nervous, although I'm in last talk. Okay, good evening, Venerables and Dharma friends. It's a pleasure to be here to share with you some Dharma teachings. I hope you all had a good day at work and uni. Tonight I would like to share with you some points about meditation, which comes from Venerable Yinshen's teachings on the Paramita of Dhyana. We only have 30 minutes, so let's make it short but sweet. Before we start, let's think about this. What should meditation look like? Should it be look like this sitting posture, lying down like this, walking, standing, or at work? Which one? Well, I think I will not give you the answer. But I hope you can get the answer by the end of this talk. Okay, first of all, let's look at the term meditation. The word meditation encompasses many states of concentration. Regarding meditation, the Chinese term it relates to is chana, which comes from the Sanskrit term dhyana. Dhyana is translated as quiet or calm contemplation or meditation. Apart from dhyana, there's also the Sanskrit term samadhi, which sometimes is the synonym of dhyana. Samadhi is translated as quietude, stillness, or concentration, and so on. In Buddhist texts, samadhi is explained as the mind being focused on a single object, and this inner mind state is sustained. This definition is also used for tranquility. The Sanskrit term is shamatha. In this talk, the word tranquility is used to refer to this state of sustained and sole focus on a single object. This is the level of meditative concentration that can develop true wisdom. In the Bodhisattva practice, as well as the Theravadan practice, tranquility and insight, that is wisdom, are in perfect harmony and are inseparable. Thus, both have to be cultivated. When the two are in a good balance, they become powerful. So, in Buddhism, where meditative states possess both concentration and wisdom, the term dhyana or samadhi are used as part of their names. For example, in the Shravaka practices, there are the samadhi of emptiness and the dhyana of ultimate truth. In the Mahayana, There are the Suramgama Samadhi and Tathagata Dhyana. So, remember, Dhyana and Samadhi often refer to special meditative states where both concentration and wisdom is present. On the other hand, even though concentration and wisdom are inseparable, they are not identical. From the perspective of practice, there is the difference between the characteristics and the function of the two. This can be clearly seen by looking at the practices of the three progressive trainings and the six paramitas. In these two sets of practices, meditation and wisdom are separately identified. For a practitioner of Buddhism, it is imperative to understand clearly the distinction between tranquility and insight. Otherwise, we may mistake tranquility for insight. Here, insight is the synonym of wisdom. You may think, oh, what's the big deal? Let me share with you a story to highlight the importance of knowing the difference. In a treatise, there was a monk who practiced diligently, and he gained the fourth dhyana. In this state, everything ceases temporarily, and his defilements were so subdued, he mistook them to be eradicated, and concluded he had become an enlightened arahat. However, at the time of his death, he could see his next life, which is not possible for an arahat. So this led him to think that the Buddha's teachings on nirvana were false. So anger and resentment arose, and he denounced the practice. As a result of negativity and intensity of his mind state at the point of death, he was born in hell and lost the human form. This is such a pity. So please bear in mind this important point that tranquility and insight are not the same. When cultivating tranquility and insight, we should first cultivate it, tranquility. This is not to say that we must fully accomplish tranquility first and then move on to practice insight. In fact, practices of tranquility and insight are mutually beneficial. Before achievement of tranquility, there are different kinds of insight or wisdom, such as wisdom from listening and learning the Dharma, and the wisdom from contemplation of the Dharma teachings. What this really means is we must make good progress in the cultivation of tranquility. Then the development of insight practice will be well supported. So without a good foundation in tranquility, the cultivation of insight will be flawed. In the sutras, each time they talk about tranquility and insight, or jhana and prajna, it is always the case that they first explain jhana and then comes prajna. When we actually cultivate tranquility and insight, you will understand for yourself how these practices follow a natural order. Venerable Yinshen summarized the benefits of dhyana using this half verse. The verse says, tranquility gives rise to strength and endurance, and one incurriously progresses to complete all tasks. The drive for us to diligently practice a method or learn a skill comes from knowing what the result will be. The attainment of tranquility allows the mind to remain focused, concentrated, and tranquil. This gives the mind strength and the power of endurance. This is the energy source for us to accomplish many meaningful and beneficial tasks. Therefore, there is the Chinese saying, with a mind that is trained to stay focused, then nothing is impossible. Have you heard of this? Good. This is not hard to understand. Just reflect on when you have carried out tasks with the relatively focused mind compared to when your mind is scattered or half-hearted. Which scenario usually yields the better result? I think everyone should have the same answer. I hope so. So, when the cultivation of tranquility achieves the state where the mind calmly settles on the mental object and is able to sustain this focus for a long time, then bliss and peace is initiated in the body and mind. The body and mind becomes enlivened while being at ease. It becomes filled with the strength to do good and depart from evil. This also highlights the problem of our mundane states. Normally, our minds of the minds of ordinary beings are in a scattered state. Consequently, the strength to resist temptations, the discipline to tame afflictions, and the will to undertake good deeds are all very weak. It always seems that the intention to do good is there, but the energy is missing to follow through. This situation also applies to the physical body. Even in times of good health and fitness, there will be instances where we feel weak and irritated, similar to the situation of having chronic illness, where the body and mind feel burdened, heavy, and weak, with no energy, sort of like rowing a boat against the current. Can you catch what I am talking about? Yes? Yeah. I hope so. Okay. So, when cultivating tranquility, if we can abide in right meditation, we can then rely on this calm and settled mind to develop strength and endurance. This means the physical and the mental bliss we experience from tranquility allows the body and mind to develop energy and diligence. As a result, things that were thought to be impossible and unbearable become viewed in a totally different light. So, for practitioners, the attainment of tranquility allows the body and mind to develop bliss, peace, virtues, and even superhuman powers. With these qualities, we can then delve deep into the Dharma and become more adept in undertaking the many deeds that benefit sentient beings. So, I hope you can start to see the importance of cultivating tranquility. Now, let's look at the key element to achieving tranquility. For beginners like you and me, a big challenge is the wandering mind, isn't it? The minds of sentient beings are normally excited and scattered, or torpid and sleepy, like some of you. That means when the mind is alert and clear, it is often scattered and chasing many objects. On the other hand, when the mind is calm, it tends to become a torpid and fall asleep. A mind that is torpid lacks clarity and is weak without power. A mind that is alert but scattered is like a flame in the wind that flickers about, just you saw on the map, yeah, wherever Yanrong presented. So it is of not much usefulness. So meditation helps us train the mind to deal with being scattered or torpid. When cultivating tranquility, the key point is to settle the mind onto a single mental object, keeping it calm and also clear. To do so, we need to rely on right recollection. Right recollection causes the mind to latch onto a single mental object, just like a rope that binds the mind to the object so that it does not wander off elsewhere. Here, when we talk about mental object for the purpose of meditation, it cannot be just any object. Object means a mental image of something that was previously encountered. So it is the past familiar object. It cannot be something that is pure fantasy and conjured up in your mind. So, for example, if you are using the method of recollecting a Buddha as your meditation practice, the first thing is to find the image of a Buddha you like. It's very important. If you dislike, that helpless, okay? So this could be from a picture, a statue, and so on. Then you observe that image carefully and thoroughly. Next, when actually practicing your meditation, bring up the mental image of that Buddha. Make that Buddha's image appear in your mind with all the details as it were a real Buddha. This is what is meant by a past familiar object that become your mental object or focus. If you use an imaginary object that you think of yourself, your practice to develop tranquility will not be successful. This is another example. The process is the same if you choose other objects. Some practitioners use impurity of the corpse as their object of meditation. So first, you would need to get a true image of the decaying body, either by picture of seeing a sky bureau, then observing carefully and carefully the decaying process. You use that as the basis for your mental image. Some practitioners only use the skeleton as the object of meditation, like me. Again, the idea is the same if you study the skeleton in detail and then bring up the mental image of skeleton in your meditation practice. Furthermore, right recollection also counteracts the fault of forgetting the noble teachings. Noble teachings here can refer to the instructions on the Dharma by the Buddha, Bodhisattvas, Arahats, and great teachers. This also includes the instructions on meditation. When we forget the instructions, it also means we lose our way in terms of practice. By taking the noble teaching as the object or focus, each thought then stays with the teachings and does not forget them. This prevents the mind from turning elsewhere or wandering off. By not forgetting the teachings, we can apply them during the meditation practice. For example, when obstacles arise, we can recall the instructions and apply the remedies as needed. Gradually, the mind will settle down as we become more skillful in our meditation. But remember, a mind that is tranquil must have both clarity and focus with regard to the mental object. If you fall into the situation where there is focus and no clarity of the mental object, the mind can lose interest and become torpid. Some people think that when I practice, I do not behold any object. I do not differentiate. The mind does not need to settle onto a single object. And yet, I can still practice and make achievements in meditation. This is obviously a misunderstanding. Even if they do not attach to any image and their minds do not differentiate, they still need to have a level of understanding towards their practice, isn't it? Only then can they single-mindedly undertake the practice. So, in their case, the practice becomes the mind's object of focus. Take some Chan Buddhist practitioners' practice as example. They bring to mind the question, who is recollecting the Buddha? Who is carrying around this dead body? With these questions, they give rise to a great bolt of doubt. This method is slightly different to recollecting the Buddha or impurity, but the aim is the same, to cause the mind to settle and focus onto one point and weaken the influence of many other discursive thoughts. So, although there is no image for an object in this case, it is now replaced with the question, can you see the point? Good. The mental object or focus chosen for meditation is not fixed for everyone, but at the same time, it cannot be just any object. There are two main criteria that determines what objects can be used. This is shown in this verse. The sages teach that this object of focus must be able to tame and remove defilements. It also accords with the ultimate truth and is able to direct one towards liberation. Very poetic, isn't it? Okay. The first criterion is that the object must be able to tame and or eradicate defilements. In fact, meditation is achieved through the practice of removing defilement. So, if an object is able to help you subdue your defilements and stop them from arising, this is an object that meets this criterion. Focusing on such an object will help you develop right meditation. Such objects can include objects of impurity to help us detach from lust and desire, or object of compassion to counteract anger and hatred, and so on. If an object does the reverse and stimulates or increases your afflictions and desires, such as sensual form, enemies, meaningless things, and so on, then these objects will lead you astray, and you will be very lucky if you don't go crazy. Be careful. Okay. The second criterion is that the object must accord with the righteous doctrines. There are five categories of objects that fit this criterion. These objects are the five aggregates, the 18 elements, the 12 fields, dependent origination, and knowing what is true cause and what is not. Many technical terms. These are the five types of objects that accord with the righteous doctrines and are able to eliminate ignorance regarding the truth. Due to time constraint, I will conclude this brief talk here, and we'd like to quickly recap what we discussed. Meditation is the training of mind and includes many states of concentration. The important meditative state for the development of wisdom or insight is the state of tranquility. This is the state where the mind can focus on a single object with clarity and sustain this focus and clarity without distractions for a long time. Tranquility gives the body and mind strength and endurance to undertake tasks that may seem too hard, and also the power to resist temptations and unwholesomeness. Tranquility forms the foundation for the cultivation of insight. As we work towards developing tranquility, an important tool is the application of right recollection. We need to recollect the mental object always, and this connects the mind to the mental object. The chosen mental object must be something that you have become familiar with, and it must possess two qualities. One is the ability to tame or eradicate afflictions. The other is it must accord with the truth. I hope that with these points in mind, your practice of meditation progresses well and you attain tranquility pretty soon. Remember, don't mistake the clarity that arises in tranquility to be insight. After attaining tranquility, we must use this foundation to develop insight and ultimately attain true wisdom. Only with true wisdom is liberation possible. Make sense? Thank you. So this is my talk today, and I hope you gain some benefits from the talk. Thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you.